السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. أعوذ بالله السميع العليم من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله وسلم على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. قال الله في كتابه الحكيم، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم: وأنذر عشيرتك الأقربين، واخفض جناحك لمن اتبعك من المؤمنين. صدق الله العلي العظيم، وصل على محمد وآل محمد. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. So in the past few nights we've been learning about some of the influential women in the early history of Islam. And I'd like to hone in on a couple of those personalities. And it's interesting because sometimes we tend to, in a male-dominated society, we tend to underestimate the impact and the influence that some of these women had in the life of Rasulullah. Not only in that they took him in and they nurtured him physically and spiritually, but also the impact that they had on the development of his character, the development of his persona. There's no detachment between physical upbringing and character development. Our character is developed and influenced by the people who spend the most amount of time with us. The people that we spend time with the most are those, whether we like it or not, that influence our character, that influence our behavior. So you can't say that I'm going to spend time with this person, but I'm not going to let their negativity rub off on me, or I'm not going to let their negative character affect me. Once you choose the association, you don't choose the influence anymore. But you can choose your association, which means you can control that influence. And so sometimes, you know, we underestimate the power of the impact and influence that some of these women had in the life of the Prophet. Yesterday, you heard about Khadija, the loyal wife of the Prophet, the one that the Prophet would long for many years even after her death, after her passing away, and that he would continue to remember her positive attributes and her impact and her contribution, and that he would even receive, not only did he love Khadija, but he loved the friends of Khadija, that when he would see the woman friends of Khadija, he would recognize them. And he would embrace them with love and care and compassion because of the bond of friendship that existed between her and them. So there are two personalities that I want to mention, one in particular that I'll focus on, but one of those early women, part of that early community, was Lubaba. And Lubaba was the wife of Al-Abbas, who was the uncle of the Prophet. And Lubaba was a close friend of Khadija, one of her closest friends. And in fact, Lubaba was the second woman, the second lady to convert to Islam, right after Khadija. And Lubaba was a woman of initiative. You know, traditionally when we talk about leadership and initiative, traditionally, we say that the man, he's the one that he takes initiative and he directs the family in which direction that they should go. But in this case, Lubaba was the one to take initiative. In fact, she converted to Islam 20 years before her husband did. It took her husband 20 years, Al-Abbas, the uncle of the Prophet, to convert to Islam. And she did it right away. And she had a special relationship with Rasulullah. And she had initiative. You know, There are many instances in Islamic history where it was the women, the wives, the mothers, they were the ones that took leadership and they were the ones that took initiative to guide the family in the right direction. When they tell the story of what happened to Imam Hussein and his family and companions, after the massacre, the army of Umar ibn Sa'd prevented the people, the residents, the natives of Karbala from going out and burying the bodies of Imam Hussein and the companions. And they told them that whoever does that shall be punished, they shall suffer the same fate. And the tribe that lived there, the tribe of Banu Asad, the men were too afraid, they were too intimidated. And so they decided not to leave their houses. The woman looked to them and they said, "Really? You're going to allow the bodies of the family of the Prophet and the companions to sit out there under the sun?" And so the women risked their lives. They weren't afraid. They risked their lives despite the intimidation and despite the threat. And they took initiative and then their men followed suit. So Lubaba was a woman of initiative. And she was a woman of bravery. In fact, it's said that when the Muslims migrated from Mecca to Medina, the first major battle that took place between the people of Mecca and the people of Medina was the Battle of Badr. And that was a decisive victory in favor of the Muslims. There were a number of Muslims that remained in Mecca. They could not travel, they could not migrate for whatever reason. One of those was a man by the name of Abu Rafi', and Abu Rafi' was a bondsman of Al-Abbas, the uncle of the Prophet. So Abu Rafi', when he hears about the Muslim victory, he rejoices publicly. He begins to celebrate and rejoice. So Abu Lahab, who's mentioned in the Quran, the uncle of the Prophet, the staunch enemy of the Prophet and the Muslims, Tabbat yada Abi Lahabin watab, he goes up to Abu Rafi' and he punches him. And he gets on top of him and he starts to beat him. Now, the Muslims, again, they're a small community, and so every movement that they make is under strict control and is watched. So Lubaba, seeing that nobody else is taking the initiative, she grabs the pole of a tent and she walks up to Abu Lahab and she cracks him over the head. And she splits his skull open. And a week later he dies of infection in defense. So she didn't wait for somebody to act. She went and took the initiative. Another one of those women was Ayman. And Ayman originally was a bondswoman. And her name was Baraka bint Tha'laba. And Ayman proved to be very influential in the life of the Prophet. Ayman was a bondswoman that was owned by Abdullah, the father of the Prophet. But the Prophet decided to set her free. And he decided to set her free on the day of his wedding to Khadija, as a sign of thanks to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So he set her free. And by the way, just a word about slavery. When we talk about slavery, bondsmen, bondswoman, when we say the word slavery, people tend to think of the Hollywood version of slavery or the American history version of slavery. You think of shows, TV shows and movies like Roots and Amistad and Django and 12 Years a Slave. You think of barbarity and people that are dragged from their homeland and they work on cotton fields and they're whipped and they're raped and they're beaten and they're executed for their insolence. And that's not what we're talking about when we talk about slavery. See, Islam came into a world where slavery was already universally practiced. And so the Quran and the Hadith promoted kindness and ethical and humane treatment towards slaves, towards bondmen and bondswomen. And the Quran encouraged the freedom and the emancipation of slaves. And so slaves were not really perceived in the same way that we perceive slavery when we say slavery in Western history or American history. In fact, slaves had rights like other human beings, and even in some cases, if you study Islamic history, slaves became military commanders and then they became rulers. So if you study Islamic history, you'll find that what they call in Western history, the Mamluks. And the word Mamluk is Mamluk, which refers to someone who is owned. The Mamluks, they ruled parts of Egypt, they ruled parts of Khorasan, they ruled parts of India. These were slaves who eventually, through their control, became military commanders and became rulers of empires. And slavery in the Islamic context was never tantamount to racism. Even in the United States, when we talk about slavery, even 100 years, up to 100 years after the emancipation of slaves, there was still racial segregation. And so the model of quote-unquote Islamic slavery was not segregation, but rather integration. They were integrated within society. Slaves could purchase their freedom from their masters. And in fact, the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, they made it a habit to purchase slaves and then free them. Such was the case with Salman al-Muhammadi. And Salman, arguably, was the closest companion to the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. The closest person to the Prophet after his own family, after his own Ahlul Bayt. So just a note to clear up the stigma when we mention slavery and the stories of early Islamic history that have to do with slavery. So Ayman, going back to the story of Ayman, Baraka bin Tha'laba, she was a bondswoman, a slave that had been set free by the Prophet. So when the Prophet set her free on the day of his marriage to Khadija, who herself was also a wealthy woman, allowed him to take one of her own bondsmen, and that bondsman was Zayd ibn Haritha. And Zayd has a very interesting story, and I'll mention his story because down the road, Zayd ends up marrying Ayman. So a free man ends up marrying a free woman. And Zayd was a young man who was brought to Mecca as a slave, and he was given to Rasulullah, and Rasulullah took him in, and he treated him with compassion. He treated him with love. He treated him with kindness, so much so that there was an intense bond between the two. The Prophet became like a father figure to Zayd. And by the way, this Zayd that I'm talking about is mentioned in the Quran in chapter 33. فَلَمَّا قَضَى زَيْدٌ مِنْهَا وَطَرَى. The name of Zayd is mentioned in the Quran. So what happened, you know, down the road after they had developed this intense bond and this relationship is the father of Zayd and the uncle of Zayd, they come to Mecca because they heard that he was taken as a slave. He was kidnapped and taken as a slave to Mecca. So they come to Mecca looking for him. And they finally found him. So they come to the Prophet and they say, name the price, whatever it is. We want to purchase Zayd from you. So when the Prophet sees that it's his father and his uncle, he says, I won't refuse. I mean, if he chooses you, then you can take him. You don't have to pay me anything. So the Prophet turns to Zayd. He says, do you recognize these people? He says, yes, this is my father and this is my uncle. He says, what have you chosen? He says, I choose to stay with you, Ya Rasulullah. And he turned to him. They say, you would choose slavery over freedom? He replies to them. He says, you have no idea what this man has done in my life. And if it means that I have to remain a slave to have this relationship with him, then so be it. And so the Prophet takes them. He escorts them to the Kaaba, to where the Kaaba is. And he proclaims to the people of Mecca that Zayd is no longer my slave and now he has become my son. He becomes the adopted son of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So the narration tells us that the father and the uncle of Zayd, they leave and they didn't get what they wanted in terms of their son, the nephew, back. But they went back telling stories to their people of the intense bond of love and friendship that exists between the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and Zayd. That became a source of pride for them. And so the Prophet frees Ayman. And it's very interesting because Ayman, she was older than the Prophet. And she was one of the caretakers of the Prophet. The Prophet, his mother, Amina bint Wahab, who passed away when he was very young, who you'll learn about in the following days, was taken under the care of Halima Sa'diya, another very noble woman who you'll also learn about in the next coming days, inshallah. And another one of those women was Ayman. So Ayman became like a mother, and the Prophet would, narrations tell us that the Prophet would constantly refer to her as ya O mother. So here you have that early community. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us in the Quran, in Surah Al-Shu'ara, chapter 26, verses 214 and 215, وَأَنذِرْ عَشِيرَتَكَ الْأَقْرَبِينَ وَخْفِضْ جَنَاحَكَ لِمَنِ اتَّبَعَكَ مِنَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ Now, Ya Rasulullah, now is the right time to publicly summon, to publicly call people to the message of Islam. Because up until then, you know, the first few years, it was a private message. And there was wisdom behind that. But even though it was a private message, there were a few people that had gathered under the leadership and under the tutelage of the Prophet and become that early Muslim community. But now it was time for him to go to his aqrabin, the closest in kin. وَأَنذِرْ عَشِيرَتَكَ الْأَقْرَبِينَ God finally tells the Prophet that call to this message the people that are closest in kin. So he gathers the descendants of Abdul Muttalib and he delivers to them the message. He brings his uncle Abu Talib, Al-Abbas, Hamza, Abu Lahab, other family members. He invites them to a meal. He brings, of course, Ali, who was his confidant and who had already accepted Islam, who was the first to accept Islam. And this was a true test. This was a test of the character of Rasulullah. Sometimes you have an idea or you have a concept and the first people to put you down sometimes are your own family members and friends. And sometimes that's just a test of your character to see whether you truly believe in what you're doing or you don't believe in what you're doing. If you read the biographies of some of the greatest world leaders, some of their own people didn't believe in them. Sometimes their own wives or husbands or children or parents didn't believe in them. But what was important is they believed in what they were doing. So you know the story, some of them begin to ridicule the Prophet. Some people turn to him, they turn to the Prophet, and they said, look, they turn to each other, they said, look, he's expecting us to follow him. And then when Imam Ali alayhi salam stood up to support him, they turned to Abu Talib. And they said, look, Abu Talib, they're expecting you to follow your son. How laughable is that? But there were among the family members of the Prophet that immediately accepted the message. One was Safiya, one of the aunts of the Prophet. One of them was Ayman. Ayman also accepted Islam there. And the Prophet made a statement. Now understand this. Ayman is older than the Prophet, and the Prophet is older than Zayd. The Prophet says the following. He says that he who wants to marry one of the women of paradise, let him marry Ayman. And Zayd hears it. Now in age, she's older than him. She was like a mother to the Prophet, and the Prophet was like a father to him. So basically she was almost like a grandma to Zayd. But she was still in that marriageable age range. And Zayd was a very determined man. And he heard what the Prophet said and it went straight to his heart. And so it just so happened that a few years later, Zayd ends up marrying Ayman. And they have a number of children. One of those children is Usama ibn Zayd. And I'll mention a little bit about Usama ibn Zayd. But the Prophet used to refer, from that moment, the connection was developed between him and Ayman, and he used to refer to him as a mother. And in Medina, he used to say that all that is left, after Khadija had passed away, Abu Talib had passed away, those early supporters had passed away, he would turn to Ayman and he would tell the people, all that is left from the woman of my household is Ayman. So he would refer to her as one of the women of the household. We're told that she also developed an intense relationship and a close relationship with Fatima Zahra alayhi salam. You know, a few nights ago I spoke about Salama and how Salama, that woman of nobility, the Prophet had assigned her, out of all of the wives of the Prophet had assigned her specifically to take care of Fatima because Fatima's mother Khadija had passed away. And so Salama says that this young girl, she would teach me character. She would teach me morality. She would teach me the proper way to behave. And it's no wonder that Salama became a woman of such nobility because the character of Fatima alayhi salam would rub off on her. Well, Ayman also had a very special relationship. And one narration tells us the following, that when it came time for Fatima Zahra alayhi salam to marry Imam Ali alayhi salam, there was a celebration and festivities were held, and then everyone went home. And so the Prophet, before he left, before he departed, he turned to Ali, he said, wait for me to come back so that I could put your hand, I can join your hand with the hand of Fatima. So the Prophet left and Ayman was there. So even though everybody was asked to leave, and the Prophet intentionally at this moment asked everybody to leave. Sometimes people linger, and especially in the case of the Prophet, people would linger. And the Quran even tells the Quran tells the believers in the Quran that if the Prophet invites you to a meal or to celebrate with him, don't linger. Once you're done with your meal, leave. Don't take too much of his time. The Prophet intentionally had told people not to linger, to leave, but he had asked Ayman to stay. And so he came back and he said to Ayman, there's a beautiful exchange between them. He said, Ayman, where is my brother? So Ayman says, are you speaking about Ali ibn Abi Talib? Because he's not your brother, he's your son-in-law anymore. He said, where's my brother? Even after becoming his son-in-law, he would still consider him his brother. So she was there in those intimate moments. She was known as a woman who would always help the poor. For those of you who have been to Medina, you would notice that inside the masjid of the Prophet, south of where the area where the home of the Prophet and the homes of his wives are, there's a little bit of a, if you've noticed, there's a little bit of a platform. It's a raised platform. And this platform, during those days, that area used to be referred to as As-Suffa. And the men who had left Mecca and other places, who had come to Medina to join the Muslim community, who were homeless, who were single, not married, and who were unemployed, their landing spot, their landing zone was that area. And so it was shaded. The Prophet had ordered for that place to be shaded, so that it could be a place of rest. And the Prophet would come and he would give his best food and drink to the people that were there. Before taking it to his home, he would take it there. And whoever of the companions wanted to sponsor any of these, you know, young bachelors, they could go there and they could find whoever they wanted to sponsor. And they would give them food. And so Ayman was one of the helpers. Ayman was one of the hostesses. Even after having her own family and being married and having her own children, she made sure she dedicated a certain amount of time to helping the people that were in need. In the aftermath of the Battle of Uhud, she was one of the first ladies to arrive onto the scene. And we know that the Battle of Uhud was a massacre. The Muslims had lost that battle. Hamza, the uncle of the Prophet, one of the closest people to the Prophet, had lost his life. And so some of the first ladies, from among the first ladies to arrive on that scene, was Ayman. She wanted to help with the wounded. She wanted to help with shrouding and washing and burying the dead. She accompanied the Prophet during the Battle of Khaybar. And the Battle of Khaybar was a big deal. I mean, here is this impregnable fortress. There's a number of a fortress, and within it are smaller fortresses that are impenetrable. And of course, you know, they expected it to be a huge battle, because in order to go through those fortresses, you needed the right amount of people, you needed the right equipment. They had these big towers that they used to build, and they used to have a catapult that can launch projectiles within the fortress, or they can launch projectiles at the walls of the fortress in order to destroy them so that they can penetrate and they can go inside. And so they knew that they needed all the help that they could get. And so Ayman was there, and she was a witness to the victory. And the victory came under the leadership of Imam Ali alayhi salam, who during the first few days, because of intense pain that he had in his eyes, couldn't even open his eyes, could not lead the army. So the Prophet, the narrations tell us that he gave the standard to one person who could not go in. He gave the standard to another person who could not execute. And so when he found that these people could not execute, he turned and said, لَأَعْضِيَنَّ الرَّايَةَ رَجُلًا يُحِبُّ اللَّهَ وَرَسُولَهُ وَيُحِبُّهُ اللَّهُ وَرَسُولُهُ كَرَّارًا غَيْرَ فَرَّارًا. That I will give the standard to a man who loves the Prophet of God and loves God and is loved by God and the Prophet of God. Karrar, meaning that he's resilient, he keeps going back. Ghayra farrar, he doesn't run away, he doesn't turn away no matter what the circumstances are. So she was a witness to that. She was there when the spoils of war of Khaybar were being distributed. And she was a woman of very little means, but she saw the vast amount of spoils of war that were being distributed, so she came to Rasulullah. And again, this shows us some of the, you know, the humorous side of Rasulullah. Sometimes we think of Rasulullah as just this angry man that wanted to put everyone in check and correct everyone and conquer everything. But the Prophet had a very beautiful, very down-to-earth, humorous side to him. A very loving and compassionate side to him. So they had that relationship between them. So she comes to him, she says, Ya Rasulullah, I just have one request. She said, I just want a camel. Now, camel back in the day was like getting a... what kind of SUV? Like a hybrid Chevy Suburban. Because it can go through the desert for days without drinking water. It knew its way around. It had really thick skin, right? Nothing can kind of get in its way. So she came to the Prophet and she asked for a camel. And he said to her, he said, I'll give you the daughter of a camel. So she looked to him. She thought the Prophet was saying, I'll give you a calf, like a baby camel. She said, no, I want a camel, an actual camel. He said, I'll give you the daughter of a camel. So there was this kind of sort of tense standoff, but she realized that the Prophet was going to give her a camel because every camel is the daughter or the child of another camel. And so there was this beautiful exchange between them. So she was part, it's safe to say that she was part of that, even though she was not one of his wives, but she was almost like a mother in that she shared those very intimate times. During the happy times and during the sad times. Narrations tell us that she was there to bury Zainab, the daughter of the Prophet. One of the daughters of the Prophet. And there's dispute whether the Prophet had any other daughters beside Fatima al-Zahra, or whether these were the daughters of the sister of Khadija. Some historians say they were the daughters of the Prophet. Some say they were the daughters of the sister of Khadija, who were under the care of Khadija when she entered the home of the Prophet. Regardless, the Prophet had a very close relationship with these women, Zainab, Ruqayya, and Kulthum. And so Zainab passed away before the Prophet passed away, and again, he gathered the most intimate and the closest people to perform the burial, and Ayman was there. And in the year 8 after Hijrah, Ayman herself witnessed tragedy. She became a widow because her husband, Zayd ibn Haritha, along with Ja'far ibn Abi Talib, who was the cousin of the Prophet, the brother of Imam Ali, and Ja'far had just returned from Abyssinia, from Ethiopia. He was one of those early Muslims that left Mecca and went to Abyssinia, stayed there for a couple of decades, and then from there came to Medina. And he came back, and within a few months, he had to leave to the Battle of Mu'tah. So it was Zayd ibn Haritha, Ja'far ibn Abi Talib, Abdullah ibn Rawaha, and about 3,000 men had gone to gone north towards where northern Arabia, southern Jordan is, and the area that they landed in was known as Mu'ta. Mu'ta today is in Jordan. And they faced an army of the Byzantine Empire under the rule of Heraclius. And if you look at a map of the Byzantine Empire, it stretched all across, basically around the Mediterranean Sea. So Egypt, what is present-day Palestine, parts of Turkey, parts of southern Europe, all of that was under the control of the Byzantine Empire. And there were Arab tribes that lived in the north of Arabia. They spoke Arabic, but they were Christian in faith. So they were allies of the Byzantine Empire, the Ghassanids. And they wanted to go to war against the Muslims, because the Prophet had sent 15 messengers after the first Umrah in order to go to them and engage with them, and they had killed 14 of them. So because of that act of aggression, the Prophet sent that battalion under the leadership of Ja'far and Zayd, and they went up there. What happened was that the Muslims were defeated in that battle. Only 12 people were killed, but out of those 12 were the three commanders that the Prophet had placed. And it's very miraculous if you read the narrations, because as the battle was happening, the Prophet was simultaneously, as it was happening, describing the events of battle to his companions in Medina, hundreds of miles away. And so it was there that the news of the martyrdom of Ja'far came, and the news of the martyrdom of Zayd. And so he went to the home of Ayman to deliver his condolences. And Ayman was there, her son Usama was there. And even though Ayman had lost her husband in the way of Islam, she decided to stick by the Prophet and to spend her final days with the Ahlul Bayt. Now what was very, very interesting is that Ayman had a son from Zayd by the name of Usama, Usama ibn Zayd. And by the age of 17, Usama had already displayed how competent he was in the battlefield. So much so that the Prophet, during the final days, had made Usama ibn Zayd a commander of one of the battalions. And here he is, 17 years old, 18 years old, and he's leading the senior companions, men that were in their 40s and their 50s and their 60s. And so some of them were very fed up. And some of them did not understand, why is it that the Prophet is bringing someone who's so young to lead us? And it was the same story repeated, because only a few years earlier the Prophet had taken a man, a young man, by the hand when he was only 10 years old. And that was Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, and had told the people of his capability, his ability to lead the nation. So 3,000 men during the last days of the Prophet, 3,000 men were sent again towards Palestine under the leadership of Usama. And Ayman, his mother, was there by the bedside of the Prophet during those final days when the Prophet was falling ill, in order to send the news to her son, because her son had heard that the Prophet had fallen ill. So he stopped where he was in his path, and he said that, I'm not going to continue until I hear about the Prophet, until I am sure about what has happened with the Prophet. Now, in Shi'i history, there's a little bit of controversy, because Usama ibn Zayd was one of the people who refused to pay allegiance to Imam Ali alayhi salam when Imam Ali was mobilizing his troops for the Battle of Jemen. However, narrations later came, one narration by Al-Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, it says that he later regretted his decision. So when you speak of him in kindness, speak of him in goodness. And so you see that Ayman, even though she was freed from being a bondswoman, even when she was freed from quote-unquote slavery many, many years earlier, she had such an intense, intimate relationship with the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalam, that she decided that she wanted to stay. She wanted to be with them. She wanted to spend her entire life with them. There was no one else that she wanted to spend her life with. And she was there during those final moments when the Prophet began to take his final breaths, and at that moment she sends word to her son Usama, and Usama, he comes back and he sees the Prophet in the state, and he embraces him and he kisses him. And as the Prophet passed away, the people of Medina began to weep. And Ayman began to weep. People turned to her and asked her why she was weeping. She said, I do not weep for him because the Prophet is in a better place. I weep for us. I weep for what is to come of us. Because divine grace and revelation shall no longer be revealed to us. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allahumma ighfir lil mu'minina wal mu'minat wal muslimina wal muslimat al ahya'i minhum wal amwat tabi' baynana wa baynahum bil khayrat إنك مجيب الدعوات إنك قاضي الحاجات إنك على كل شيء قدير برحمتك يا أرحم الراحمين وصلى الله وسلم على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين